for lack of a better word, it's been kind of a schizophrenic week on matters of ultimate concern, if you will, to use Paul Tillich's phrase. Last weekend we were in Minneapolis, and it was really a hoot baptizing little Noah Wongard, who's about a year and a quarter, almost walking, in a beautiful freshwater lake in Minneapolis. And as the plane landed in Lubbock, you know, you can turn your phones back on when that happens. And I turned the phone back on, and there was a text message from Nikki Pollard, who said that, can you come to the hospital? Just then. And, of course, Jay's life ended on Wednesday, and we had the funeral yesterday. Monday was Frances Camp's 95th birthday. Talked to her on the phone. And on the same day, we commend Jay back to God. We get George among us. And he's got a couple of pretty great grandparents, from what I could tell. It's a little bit like that opening of the old Ben Casey television show. It was just a blackboard, and a hand would come on and draw the symbols for man, woman, birth, death, infinity. Matters of ultimate concern. And going back to the baptismal weekend, we spent a lot of time talking with family, and on a couple of occasions, matters of ultimate concern came up in the context of, you know, what a baptism is, what it means or doesn't mean, and so on. We were talking about and pondering together, well, when did the idea come up that you had to be baptized to get into heaven? And then the debate over that is profound and is largely the subject of a whole other sermon or maybe a whole other course on the sacraments. The answer to that question, by the way, the simple answer is no. But there was an instance where I think maybe it took root when the Emperor Constantine in the year 337 intentionally delayed his own baptism until his deathbed so that he probably couldn't screw it up once he got baptized, you know. So there was that, and then the church sort of institutionalized that. But then the larger question, when did heaven and hell, if you will, become in our minds literal places to which we have a, you know, without other factors, a coin flip's chance of winding up in either or, you know, at the end of our lives. And I was thinking about that, and I'm going to get to the text here in just a second. There are lots of traditions that suggest that heaven is a place and hell is a literal place of anguish on one hand and paradise on the other. But it's not as clear-cut as you think, although there are a couple of places in the New Testament, actually, where we get that idea. Two stories that are similar in one respect, but with a very different nuance. So I want to use that nuance at the end to kind of put the idea of heaven and hell in perspective. That's the deal for this morning. This is the text that we read yesterday and which we always read, or not always, but most always read, in the context of conducting a funeral and ushering that transition from one to the other. Jesus says in chapter 14 of John's Gospel, "Let not your hearts be troubled. Believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house are many mansions. If it were not so, would I have told you that I go to prepare a place for you? And when I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and take you to myself, that where I am, you may be also." Heaven is a specific place, Jesus says. Literally or metaphorically, no one knows. But it is the place where we are with him. Now, I remember as a child in church school classes learning from what turned out to be a very wise and gentle and kind person and teacher when we were talking about this as children. How do you explain heaven to a child? And I'll never forget the very simple explanation that oddly made a great deal of sense for me, that heaven is less a place than a condition of being with God. Now, I'm learning that as a 7-year-old. I get to seminary many years later and studying at the graduate level theology. And I learn that sin is also not so much things that we do or fail to do or can't prevent, but it's a condition of being separated from God, that the most profound theological definition of sin is separation. And I learned as a 7-year-old, the most profound definition of heaven is being with God. Now, what's interesting to me is that as Jesus describes both the place and the promise, there's no qualifier. He simply says, I go to prepare a place for you. End of story. Heaven in perspective is a condition of being with, perhaps reunited with, the God who created us in the heavens and the earth, and for all we know, everybody else. No qualifier. So that's in part, and I think in part Jesus is using that metaphor and terminology because he knows the limits of our own understanding. We know place, you know, solid, mansion, rooms, if you will. But the larger point is that wherever the place is, literal, spiritual, metaphorical, unimaginable, it is a condition of being with the one who created all things and us. That's heaven in perspective. Well, what about the other side of the coin? Turns out, it's a fairly profound discussion of hell as well. In Matthew 25, in which there are several what are called parables of the kingdom. The chapter starts out with the parables of the 10 wise and foolish maidens. It's got the parable of the talents. And then it closes with this. Jesus says, when the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the angels with him, then he will sit upon his glorious throne. Before him will be gathered all the nations, and he will separate them one from another as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. And he will place the sheep at his right hand, but the goats at the left. Then the king will say to those at his right hand, come ye blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you welcomed me. I was naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. I was in prison, and you came to me. Then the righteous will answer him, Lord, when did we see thee hungry and feed thee, or thirsty and give thee drink? And he said, when you have done it unto the least of these my brethren, you did it unto me. And then what closes that chapter is the parallel where the unrighteous say, when didn't we do that, when you did not do unto the least of these my brethren? Now what's interesting to me is that the depiction of heaven as a physical place, literally or metaphorically in John's Gospel, is simply a statement of what is. The depiction of hell as a physical place where some go and some don't and the sheep and the goats are separated, that story ends with an imperative. The point of that story, I think, is not to frighten us into wondering whether we've got a shot at one or the other, but to highlight the fact that the least of these, his brethren, are the imperative for our ministry. That if you want to get close to where Jesus is, and here's the parallel to the mansion story. Jesus is found wherever you have done it unto or failed to do unto the least of these, my brethren, you've done it unto me. That's where you find Jesus. So that's a mission. It's an imperative having less to do with the threat of going someplace evil for eternity than to be jarred out of our complacency and suggests that if you want to find Jesus now, you find him with the least, the last, and the lost, which sets up a ministry of things we can control in light of what we cannot control, what happens to us after our life ends. I think that's intriguing. I was talking to my students this week in a lecture entitled Self and Society, which is really the essence of what sociology is, examining the nuances and dynamics of individuals in a larger context. This is as a way of illustrating who are the least of these Jesus brethren. And I simply made the offhanded remark that any American college student has by and large hit the lottery in terms of life chances in comparison to the worldwide population. Who is sitting in an American university exchanging ideas and learning and getting credentialed for employment in a capitalist economy in a developed country, as opposed to what? I know that statistics make our heads hurt, but there are a couple that are rather profound. We define poverty in the U.S. as substandard housing and malnutrition. Poverty worldwide is defined much differently. In a planet on which there are 6 billion people, 3 billion, 50% of the world's population, live under conditions where their daily wage is less than $2.50. do the arithmetic, add that out on a yearly basis. Half the world's population, 250 a day or less. 8 out of 10 worldwide residents of God's creation live on $10 a day or less. Any American college student has hit the lottery with regard to life chances worldwide. Now, this is not intended to make us feel guilty, because we're certainly in that same boat. I think it is intended, both in the light of what Jesus said in Matthew's gospel and in, you know, what we teach in sociology, the intent is not to make us feel guilty, but to make us feel grateful. And out of that sense of gratitude, give us the opportunity and the wit and the will to be generous. In other words, to reach out and tend to and find the least of these, his brethren. I got an email from a student that echoed a question I've gotten a dozen times in this first week of class. What do we have to learn to do well on the test? What should we write down? What do you want us to know? And I thought about that before giving a flip answer, and then gave the answer, or then I thought of the answer I would like to give, and then gave the answer that was helpful to them. But the answer I would like to give is, what you have to do well on the test is what you have to do well in life. You have to do anything that helps you become more inquisitive, that helps you become more tolerant, that helps you become more generous, because that will help you learn to live in the company of others, yourself in society. And, of course, the details on that are what they want to know, like what specifically in your lecture did you say that we have to memorize, put on the test, and forget? Well, if you learn whatever it is in life, or whatever it is that you learn in college or even in my class, anything that makes you more inquisitive, tolerant, and generous, you'll do fine on the test. Similarly, I think that as we read these, in one sense, really scary passages, we move off a sense of complacency and begin to wonder, and then as we live our lives, start to figure out, where have we seen thee, hungry, thirsty, imprisoned, etc.? In other words, where do we find you? Well, anything that helps us become more grateful. Little George is a good start on that one right now. Anything that puts us into the vitality of life with gratitude, I think will help us be more generous. Because what can you do with abundant blessings except to share them? You see, I'm not sure whether heaven is a place or a condition. I'm not at all sure hell even exists, except perhaps in the context of the hellish conditions under which 8 out of 10 of us live. And if we remember only that, we have the imperative to reach out with gratitude, with just a little more generosity. Anytime we feel more grateful or more generous, I think we get a foretaste of the feast to come, because gratitude and generosity must be constitutive features of the heavenly world. And anytime we reach out in generosity, I think we make hell on earth a little more remote for one of the least of these, his brethren. And in perspective, in the here and now, that's all we can control. We have today, and that's it. And our job in the here and now is to find Jesus in the least of these, his brethren. Amen. P.S. That means we got a real good chance of finding him in the many mansions.